We know of new methods of attack.
And then we can start.
The Trojan horse.
We are both.
The fifth column.
Out in the country.
Yeah.
Which will be happening a lot more as New York City becomes more Danish and Dutch and Swiss and Swedish for the summer. And the weather gets nicer.
Yeah, although if it's getting really Swedish, from what I understand from the Bill Maher program, that means there's going to be a lot of bad things happening.
Wait,
see,
what?
He went to
Sweden?
No, he allegedly tore off on how Swedish society got changed by all the Islamist immigrants, and that there's a backlash to it. And
I mean, it's pretty true. you got to acknowledge that that's to a certain extent true. I mean, when you go from having a very low crime rate to not having a low crime, I mean, and of course, relative to Americans, you know, it's a walk in the park, but it's still gotten worse. And Swedes really like being Swedish, but they don't want to tell you it.
Yeah.
You know, Fredrik Reinfeldt, the prime minister, the quote unquote conservative prime minister who wasn't conservative at all, very famously said that there's no such thing as Swedishness, which pissed people off. But that's just kind of, that was the conservative guy.
Very afraid
of nationalism.
What were Danes' opinion on the non-existence of Swedishness?
They're like, well, who do we hate this much? What do you call them? And also, Danes are very much a more nationalistic people than the Swedes. They had the Danske Folkepartiet, the Danish People's Party, was popular long before Sweden had its version of Sverigedemokraterna, the far right, whatever you want to call it, populist party, which it's really popular now.
It's been a while since I thumbed through my well-thumped copy of Nations and Nationalism by Ernest Gellner. I wonder who ends up being more nationalistic, the regional bully or the people who are always like fighting for independence from or latitude from the regional bully. I would guess that the Danes are going to be more nationalistic. And I mean, like 1848 nationalisms were... yes, they were reassertions of languages that had been suppressed and cultures, and we're going to get into our own folklore, and all of our great composers are going to go out and make classical music out of our folk songs. But a lot of it was just like, fuck you, Vienna.
Yeah. I don't know if it's still the case. I have to look this up, but way back in the 2000s, I remember looking this up, and, you know, Americans were very nationalistic, you know, I was answering one of these global Gallup surveys about, you know, are you proud of your country kind of thing. And America was always number one. But in Europe, number one was always Ireland, which didn't really surprise me in so many ways. But I also love the fact that immigration is starting to come to Ireland and they're starting to freak out. And you see the kind of, you know, with these riots they had a couple months ago. And I wonder what would have happened if that ever happened in Japan. You think of these kind of homogenous states, like what do they do? The Swedes just kind of took it and they were like, it will be fine. And it's like, maybe. I think it's going to change things a lot. And, you know, ultimately, maybe it will be fine. But I mean, right now, not at all. You see a lot of like murders. I mean, there was like one handgun crime, I think, the whole time I was in Sweden. And it was like a Bosnian guy who had an AK-47 that he picked up at Srebrenica and put in his backpack. You know, but this now is the leading gun crime. It's like the gun crime capital of Europe or something. I saw this the other day.
Wow, they had like five last year or something.
Yeah, it was like 20. Yeah.
Didn't you send me some French stuff? Just
I don't know if that's true because I can't see anything. Well, I can't see anything on any French media about this, which is what you're supposed to do when you see a bunch of, you know, kooks, you know, posting videos of people rioting. And it was some Afghan people rioting, and you could tell because one was wearing an Afghanistan flag as a cape while setting things on fire. But yeah, the French don't love that stuff either. So,
yeah, and the sad thing about the media contraction, which is everywhere in the world, you know, a lot of that is stuff that I kind of cheer, or let's say I don't mind the media industry convulsing and changing. I think creative destruction is fun, and we participate in the creation of stuff on the end of it. However, there's just less reporting out there. That when you have that instinct, like, gosh, it's the CNN instinct, which I don't even know why I still have it. Although they haven't been universally horrible during Israel-Gaza, and they have some muscle memory of kind of fact-gathering out there. But yeah, when you go in those moments of high stress and say, I want to find the journalism on this, there's less of it, and it's harder to find, and it's less good.
But there's more video, which is kind of interesting in the sense that people can go and shoot it, which is useful in so many ways. But the instinct that the person who has like a TikTok account, and you know, always you see these ones that are always, they always have the bug, what you call them, and you know, the bug in the corner that has their name. And it's always like this one called Freedom News or something that's always there.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is like, it's really useful in so many ways. But as you see with like the Nick Sandman stuff, you often need a little more than that. And the journalism part of it is, okay, talk to the organizer of the protest, interview people. And which is, by the way, very hard to do, particularly when America is in the throes of wild extremism, as it is at the moment. Again, not in a big way, but in a small way, but you know, dominating our elite institutions. And I'm talking particularly about Columbia.
I was going to say.
Yale, like, and Yale, too.
But a question about that, and I know you're lit up on that, and I can see to the extent that I'm looking at news feeds while I'm driving through the beautiful, lush, green countryside here. It is nice. Like when the grass, I can get the point of Ireland. I never do otherwise. Yeah. I imagine this is what Ireland looks like.
Very lush and green, yes. And dark lush and green. Depressing, too.
But people are pretty exercised about things in Columbia University. There's kind of a shanty town. Cops cleared it out. It's still there. A professor who's Jewish, I think, sent a letter to 250 people or email saying, you know, maybe don't just show up on campus. It's not safe anymore.
Other, I think it was the rabbi from the Chabad house or something. It's a very bad idea. You should never do that.
You should never do that.
I understand it. I understand the instinct, but it's absolutely the wrong thing to convey to people.
But my question to you is everyone just freaking out because it's Columbia and it's actually not something that's happening all over the country? Or do you think that this is reflecting a thing that's with us and growing in a year that there's guaranteed probably to have kind of a bubbling amount of not just political violence, but like rando dude self-immolation in Lower Manhattan?
Yeah, no, I think it is actually important and not. I mean, I've been oftentimes dismissive of some of the moral panics about this stuff. But, you know, I was talking about this the other day with a friend and, you know, I was talking about, you know, whatever you want to call it, what people call it wokeness and things like this, talking about the excesses in culture that just kind of became part of the mainstream. And it started becoming worrying when it was part of universities, which it's always been a part of. But then it became part of corporate culture. Then it got into the media. And then it got into your schools. And it just was kind of, you know, hatching its eggs everywhere. And we talked about that in a funny kind of way about how these crazy people, some idiot wrote this sort of stuff. But it really was kind of, to further the bird metaphor, it really was a kind of canary in the coal mine stuff, is that extremism is really taking hold amongst people when these wild views that people have are considered normal or considered like, you know, when you have a piece about NPR and the Free Press, and NPR's response is to not only defend itself, but put the guy on probation or you know, he ultimately resigns, which I understand that instinct. I've said that before. But, you know, the CEO is then realized has this passel of insane views too. The person who's running NPR. I mean, it just shows you how far that stuff's gone. Now, when you believe all that stuff, and that's just kind of the mainstream of politics for you, you're so far outside of the mainstream that when it comes to something like Israel-Palestine, the Palestinian protests have been so crazy. I mean, they have gotten to a point of such extremism that there are people
in America.
In America, that there are people. I mean, it's also the same in the UK and France and places. But that is less surprising because there's more recent immigrants, migrants, et cetera, that are directly connected to the conflict, and they're not even first generation. I mean, they're basically just there, and you see them still kind of carrying a lot from where the places they just left in the past 10 years. You know. So having those kind of politics is not totally surprising. But when you have people, you know, saying, what was the girl? I don't know who this person is. So I don't know if this is a hoax or whatever, but it looked like this was probably real. The girl with the keffiyeh on, which by the way, is a great, it's great that the Palestinian national kind of symbol also doubles as something to hide your face with. So yeah. It's not like, you know, that's a pretty coincidental thing. But this woman who has a sign that has an arrow pointing at the pro-Israel demonstrators, and it says, you know, the El Qassam targets right here, which is the, you know, the military group of Hamas that shoots rockets into Israel. Yeah, it's absolutely shocking that people would say something, some college kid. Now, somebody believes that they found who this person was, but I don't actually, I think it's really reckless to do that because it's not clear that this, I mean, the person's face was covered. We don't know who this person was, but, you know, looks, if it's a woman, we know that, a young blonde woman. But, you know, when you have people saying, you know, about the Houthis, turn another one around, make us proud, the Houthis, right? I mean, the fact that there's defenses of the October 7th massacre means we're in a place of deep extremism, wild
rhetorical,
extremism.
Public rhetorical extremism. I think that's where, and maybe I'm just like always slow on the uptake. It's hard to look at these people and not get a sense of even kind of lesser Portland, meaning which you have a lot of LARPing college students or, you know, 28-year-old maladjusted, sunken chested, whoever the hell's, LARPing on the streets. And saying insane things constantly because they're used to saying insane things without getting much pushback, but are not actually doing the terrorism. They're not going in and like and starting a bomb. I mean, there's more, I think, explicit terrorism so far that were connected with the George Floyd protests. Like people, I'm going to throw a Molotov cocktail into a cop car. We haven't seen that yet. And I wonder, I don't think there's an answer to it. I wonder if we're just waiting for that shoe to drop. It's kind of inevitable, especially again, presidential year. And, you know, when everyone is calling this a genocide all the time, where do you go from there when it gets ratcheted up? You know, what happens if they actually do invade Rafah fully? Like what kind of mind losing will happen then? I don't know. I don't have a sense of it yet.
No, I think that's a really good point, especially the kind of, you know, inflation of what is happening as into a genocide. This kind of idea that what is going on in Israel, you know, constitutes a genocide is something that is so bizarre to me, particularly when you actually look at these numbers in a real way. What's happening is not good. What's happening is terrible and depressing and wouldn't have happened had Hamas not invaded Israel on October 7th. But what you point out is that when you say that there's a genocide and these people are baffled if you say that there isn't, this is absolutely not happening. The people that are very sure about this, the problem with this is not just that it's wrong, it's that there's a lot of crazy people out there and they want to stop a genocide. That's how they think about it. I'm helping to stop a genocide. I'm going to help stop this by stopping, you know, the American government from funding us, we're going to, you know, blow something up. I mean, yeah, that hasn't happened. But if you look at history, if you look what happened in Germany in the 1960s, everybody's talking about Germany all the time. I mean, they're always talking about Germany because they're always talking about Nazi Germany. No one's ever talking about the late 60s and mostly through the 70s, the German autumn, as it was called, and the terror attacks from various groups that, you know, are collectively sort of called Bader-Meinhof, but there's a lot of other groups there too. And the same thing that happened in Japan with the Japanese Red Army, and the same thing that happened in Italy with Brigata Rossa. I mean, there were some other small versions. Every country had it. You know, what was it? The Blekinge Gotha gang in Denmark did like two things. You know, there was like this like little weird splinter groups. But that was a time of violence. And that was a time of violence that was justified by the Vietnam War, that was justified by, in Germany, this is a government controlled by people who were part of the Nazi machinery. Some of that was actually true, that there were people that did a little lateral move from Nazism into the Federal Republic of Germany in Bonn. But those kind of ideas allow people to very easily justify violence. It's, you know, even when you go back to Timothy McVeigh, 1994, what, you know, he wrote his stuff, he talked to Gore Vidal about this stuff, et cetera. Like, what was the justification that made sense in 1994 that America was doing on the world stage or America was doing at home? I mean, that was why the idea that we were going to have some massive uprising never made sense to me, because there has to be a moment for these things. A post-war generation is one of them. Post-war in Japan with the Japanese Red Army, it's no coincidence it happened there too. Other post-war countries remained totalitarian, so it couldn't happen, like the Soviet Union. But you look at these things that happen, and you say, oh, fuck, this is a very similar moment. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but when you have people talking about politics with the kind of psychotic, like overheated rhetoric, and they're not very bright because they're college students. They don't know anything.
Some of them belong to institutions that have some international heft and are part of the conversation. Right. I mean, there's the word genocide is being used a lot by people who have previously laid claim to a certain amount of seriousness in foreign affairs. And there's a, you can bet. And if it sounds like I'm trying to be cautious about private conversations I had this weekend, I am. But let's just say that imagine the internal dynamics that we see at media organizations that bubble up, and that we're seeing it at Penn bubbling up right now. That's happening in a lot of different institutions out there who are in the middle of those kinds of debates, and it's happening within the State Department too. A funny thing about the word genocide, which I've paid attention to a lot over the years, a lot through the prism of covering the word genocide as used regarding the Armenian genocide, right? Because for the U.S. Officially has recognized the Turkish genocide of Armenians between 1915 and 1924, which is like 1.2 million. I forget what the math is, but it's like a lot in the early days of the formation of the Turkish Republic under Ataturk, and a little bit before that. Revolutionary time. The U.S. has tried really hard not to use the word genocide over and over again. They officially recognize it as such. There's a couple of diplomatic cables. Ronald Reagan, I believe, said it explicitly. And then as part of it, Congress, who's mad about it, started April 24th, which is coming up. I should write about this, actually, as National Remembrance Day to remember genocide or something. And so the president every year is like impelled by Congress to issue a statement about this. And so one of the guessing games for decades is whether the president was going to use the G word. And every president running for office promises that he or she will. And everyone, once they get into office, doesn't. And that was like an unbroken string for decades, broken by Joe Biden. He's actually called it genocide. But one of the reasons why Americans were reluctant to is because Turkey is just furious about it. They've expended so much diplomatic energy to not have anything associated with Ataturk in any way, who's still revered and is a bit taboo to criticize over much. A bit taboo. You can go to jail. But so
friends, comrades, you're not paying for the fifth column. So therefore, you get this little message, which means that we faded you out, and we faded you out because we want you to come over and join us at wethefifth.substack.com, where you can subscribe and get all sorts of good stuff, including hundreds of other episodes. Maybe that's a little too much. Maybe you don't need hundreds of other episodes, but the rest of this episode, because we continue talking about some of the batty things that are happening in the world. I mean, good Lord, what is happening at Columbia? So more on that in the coming episodes too, I imagine. But go over there, wethefifth.substack.com, and sign up, and you can actually hear in this episode we talk about some of the stuff we have coming up this summer, including a live show in Chicago. But that has precipitated a conversation with the other less interesting people on the Fifth Column, Matt and Camille, about what are the other things we will do this summer By which I mean, what other live shows will we do? All right. So you will find out about that stuff over at wethefifth.substack.com. So you got to subscribe. You see, that's why. Because you want to see us live in Buffalo or Cleveland or wherever. Make some suggestions. But you have to subscribe to do that. Anyway, the rest of the episode is over there. And we will talk to you for a free episode very soon.